Hello, Ray.
Hello, Carl. How are you?
I'm fine. Welcome back to A Life in Biography.
Great to be with you once again after many
Great.
Years.
Okay. Some of you may have listened to our previous podcast, but just in case they haven't, you better tell them who you are, what you've been writing about, and why you wrote it.
Well, my name is Ray Boomhauer. I've written now 19 books, the majority of which have been biographies. And in the past few years, since about 2015, I've kind of focused my work on looking at the lives and times of war correspondents, particularly in the last two books, World War II correspondents, reporters who went overseas and went with American troops in the Pacific and Europe. Robert Sherrod was a reporter for Time magazine, and he was really kind of the Ernie Pyle of the Marine Corps. He followed the Marines as they barnstormed away across the Central Pacific. And after that book, I turned my attention to the life of Richard Tregaskis, who's probably best known to people today as the author of the best-selling wartime book, Guadalcanal Diary, but really traveled all across the Pacific during the war. He was a witness to the launching of the Doolittle Raid, was on an aircraft carrier during the Battle of Midway, went to Guadalcanal, and after that went over to cover the Sicilian invasion and was seriously wounded in Italy, but fought his way back to the front lines, went to Europe after the D-Day invasion. And then after that, he thought he might have enough, but he didn't. He went back to the Pacific to write for the Saturday Evening Post and went on B-29 bombing missions against Japan. And then my newest book kind of led out from my work on Richard Tregaskis. During the end of his life, he went to cover another war, the war in Vietnam, was there in the early 1960s to produce a book that he called Vietnam Diary. And he came into contact with very young correspondents who were there for various news agencies. And he traveled around the Mekong Delta with a gentleman named David Halberstam of the New York Times. And those two men, both very opinionated in their own ways and very strong personalities, clashed. And eventually, Tregaskis, when he returned to the United States, wrote a pretty harsh review of Halberstam's book about the Vietnam War called The Making of a Quagmire. And in reading that review, in doing my work on his biography, I was intrigued by a mention he made of another reporter named Malcolm Brown, who I'd never heard of before. And he recommended that people should read for a more balanced look at how the war was, Brown's book called The New Face of War. So I thought anyone who could draw Tregaskis' attention should be someone that I might be interested in. And I resolved to write a biography of Brown. And I was amazed to learn that he was the person responsible for one of the enduring images of the war, one of the iconic images you have when you think of Vietnam. There are about three, I think, and they include, of course, the dramatic execution of a suspected Viet Cong guerrilla by a South Vietnamese chief of the National Police. There's Nick Ut's famous image of the young girl naked, screaming, running down the road as a result of an accidental napalm bombing of her village. And then there's Brown's photo from much earlier in the war, from 1963, of the Buddhist monk Thich Quang Nguyen, who sacrificed his life and burned himself alive on a Saigon intersection to protest the supposed alleged discrimination of his Buddhist faith by the South Vietnamese administration of President Diem. So that's how I came to write about Brown. And I'm really comfortable in reporting about and writing about journalism because that's the profession I know, because I started out my career as a newspaper reporter myself. studied journalism at Indiana University, and worked at two small newspapers in Indiana before I started my history career and then in writing biography.
You mentioned that famous photo of the burning monk. I can imagine the impact. I mean, I was alive then. I can't honestly remember if I actually saw the photograph when it was first published, but it is a very famous photograph, which you allude to in the title of your book. And it it brought the war home, so to speak. If this is happening, what is happening in Vietnam? If a monk is set on fire like this, what's going on? It's such a disturbing image. It's so disturbing that when I posted my New York Sun review on Facebook, they didn't post the image. Here we are decades later, and they're worried about people's sensibilities, which I think, you know, the government was worried about back during the Vietnam era. And there's just such an irony here with all the controversy about Facebook and misinformation and Russian propaganda getting into the social media and so on. And then the irony of someone saying, well, you know, if you really want to look at this photo, you could click on this link and then maybe you could see it. I just thought it was extraordinary and brought home what you're talking about in your book. If you don't have an open society, some kind of democratic society, you get things like, and you deal with this in detail in your book, the DM government, which is hostile to the press, actually harms the press in all sorts of ways, including physically. And when you run a closed shop like that, how can you possibly learn the truth?
Exactly. And I think the Brown photo was controversial at that time, and it remains so. It was featured on front pages of newspapers across the country. Brown was a reporter for the Associated Press, and of course the AP as a wire service agency has client newspapers all over the world. And there were a number of newspapers, from small newspapers to medium size, that ran it on the front page. There were those, however, who just ran the story and refused to include such a gruesome, dramatic image for its subscribers, and preferred to use other photos. In fact, even the New York Times, who had a story from David Haberstam about the self-immolation, but Brown was the only one there with a camera of the Western newsman, even the New York Times didn't include it on its front pages, preferring to use a photo that Brown took of the monks who had witnessed the sacrifice, putting their bodies in front of fire trucks who arrived on the scene too late. And so they, the Times, such a vaunted newspaper, decided that particular photograph was not fit to print.
Yeah, I don't agree. I understand all these efforts, the trigger warnings and so on, to protect the delicate sensibilities of children and older people as well. It's as if they never read the Bible.
Right.
As if children aren't exposed in their schools, you know, like to bullying or whatever it is, to the cruelty of life. And that somehow you're protecting them from something that they would otherwise not know about just seems, you know, that's partly what biography is about. Yeah. You don't hold back. And Brown didn't hold back. Maybe you should say a little bit about how did he get that photograph? You know, he wasn't a photographer per se, though obviously he was taking photographs, but he was a correspondent. He was a writer.
He was. He was the head of the Associated Press Bureau in Saigon. It was a very small operation, eventually included himself, another correspondent whose name is pretty well known today, Peter Arnett. People might remember his dramatic reporting from the Iraq War.
Yes.
And there was also a photographer, a German named Horst Faus. And all three of those gentlemen won Pulitzer Prizes for their work in Vietnam. But they were, you know, it's a big country. It's a big war. There's fighting going on all over the countryside. And so they were stretched pretty thin. And so Brown, who had learned how to use a camera when he served in the American Army after the end of the Korean War. He served in South Korea after the armistice was signed. And although he was trained as a tanker, he switched to the public information office, wrote articles and did photos for the Stars and Stripes newspaper, and realized that they couldn't be everywhere at once, and it just impossible for them to do so. And he made it a policy for the staff of AP that everyone should carry a camera, and the photographer, Faust himself, when he was out in the field, should collect information. And when he came back, they could, you know, write dispatches based on what he had seen. And then Faust could turn the images, sometimes rough, produced by the reporters in help, you know, help them in the darkroom a bit so they could be sent out over the AP wire. So that's how he was able to capture the dramatic scene of Won Nook's self-immolation. He had, because of the Buddhist crisis, these religious demonstrations that were going on in the spring of 1963 in South Vietnam, had developed pretty good sources among the Buddhist monks, you know, talked to them, drank tea with them. And because he was, you know, a wire service reporter and his bosses expected him to cover any kind of breaking news, he took seriously a warning he received by the telephone in his apartment over the AP office the day before the self-immolation. And one of the monks warned him and other correspondents in Saigon that something dramatic might be happening the next day at this planned protest demonstration they had scheduled. And so Brown took those words seriously. And while other correspondents were still asleep in their beds, he was there on the scene with his camera, ready to capture that dramatic moment. He didn't know what was going to happen. He knew that though that the monks were serious and something very dramatic might happen, and it did. And he later described it as a kind of a horror. You know, it had a big effect on him personally. Later in his life, there were psychic scars that remained because of what he saw that day. And he really only thing that that kept him going in something like that, where there's a crisis during war, having something to do, was being there with his camera, trying to keep his mind off the site. You know, he decided, you know, what's, you know, my f-stop, you know, what shutter speed should I use?
Yeah.
And so that kind of helped him keep his emotions in check during this quite horrible scene that was before him. But of course, you know, that he couldn't ever forget the smell that he smelled that day.
Oh, yeah, yeah. One of the attractive things about him as a subject is his loyalty to journalism and reporting what you actually see, and not, I suppose we're all influenced to some extent, certainly by our political opinions or by an ideology and so on. But the reporter certainly is trying to make an attempt to really see what's on the ground there, what's happening. And Brown was certainly not the only reporter who was trying to do that. But some reporters do get co-opted in one way or another. They came out of World War II, people like Maggie Higgins, a biography of her I recently reviewed. And what struck me about it is that ultimately, especially by the time she got to Vietnam, she really didn't want to listen to people like Halberstam or Brown. It took her a long, long time. And I think part of the reason was she treated it like a personality conflict. Oh, that's Halberstam, you know, or that's so-and-so. It's these young generation of correspondents that don't know what they're, you know, they're just critics, they're sensationalists or whatever. You know, all kinds of motivations were attributed to people like Brown and others who were reporting the war. And when I think about my own experience in dealing with journalists, particularly, say, Martha Gellhorn, she covered World War II. Mm-hmm. And yet she was always a skeptic of government. And it was remarkable in her case because she knew powerful generals. She slept with one. She knew the Roosevelts. She had been in the White House. And yet, when she reported on something, she reported what she saw, regardless of whatever the political implications might be. And I think reporters, well, some of them become stars. Brown, we could talk about this. I think he could have, in some ways, had a different career if he had made different choices. You, in your book, for example, you talk about his effort to report the news, to be a reporter for ABC.
Right, for the television, and, yeah.
Yeah, for television. And how that was difficult for him because there were always, it's a familiar word people use now, there was the concern for optics.
Right, right.
Even the result, you know, even the advice on how to use pancake makeup.
Right, and how how to dress so you look best before the camera. But
so here's a guy who's been instructed during war to make sure you have a camera with you, and now essentially he's instructed make sure you have your makeup kit with you.
Exactly. I always found Brown a very interesting subject, especially for journalism, because he considered himself, you know, an accidental journalist. He hadn't started out his life wanting to be a reporter like I did. And from an early age, you know, I worked on my high school newspaper, was editor there, worked on the newspaper at in college at Indiana University. But he had started his life as a chemist. He was very interested in science. But he kind of learned to be a skeptic from his teachers at a Quaker institution in New York City where he was raised, the Friends Seminary. He had very good teachers who instructed him, you know, look for the facts, see what's really there before you make your final determination. And he was someone who didn't really have any fear of sticking his nose where it wasn't wanted. And he kind of used his background as a laboratory chemist when he went to Vietnam. He resolved, you know, not to treat this as journalism, but as a piece of observation that should be as accurate and as telling as possible, always looking for the truth behind the truth.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. His background in science was definitely helpful in that way. And how you would skew the results of an experiment if you were blinded by how you wanted it to turn out.
Right, if you didn't pay attention to it, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk a bit about, since there's certainly a lot of biographers listening to this podcast, how did you get the story? Obviously, you could read his newspaper reports and what people said about him. How did you go about doing it besides that?
Well, it's very helpful these days that you have, instead of going to a library, taking out microfilm rolls, putting them on the machine and getting dizzy from scrolling through the microfilm, that these days a lot of journalism is available, you know, online through services like newspaper.com. And because Brown worked for the Associated Press, just doing searches on his name, his stories appeared in, of course, newspapers all over the country. So it was easy to pick out and kind of look at his work over the years, both for the AP and also later for the New York Times. But the bulk of the research I did was done in Washington, D.C. at the Library of Congress that has his papers there. And I knew I was on track early on when I came across a letter that really encapsulated his view of what journalism was. He said in a letter to a reader who had wrote him, you know, in a free society, the duty of all newsmen is to tell all of the people, all of the truths, all of the time. The newsman is obliged to fight forces that interfere with this vital process. From there on, it is the job of the people themselves to make up their minds how they feel and for what or for whom they will fight. But to decide wisely, the people must have the facts, and that is our job. And I came across this letter and really thought, well, there is the epigraph to my book about Brown. It fit perfectly for that purpose.
Yeah.
And also, I was very helped early on in the process because of COVID restrictions. I couldn't get to New York and go through the AP's corporate archive, but the staff there did yeoman work in helping me out however they could, giving me online access to some collections. And so they were a great help, and I couldn't really have done the book without the kindness of archivists all over the country.
Yeah, this is a comment I'd make, and not just pertaining to your book, but to COVID in general. My work on biography was also helped by archivists who were busily digitizing things in many cases. In a sense, they were forced to because their institutions were closed for quite some time. So with places like Smith College and the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, I got material which 10 years ago, even if it could have been digitized, wasn't.
Exactly.
In a way, this unfortunate pandemic, on the one hand, it certainly hampered biographers in some way, but in other ways, especially if you were really immobilized, you couldn't travel, the material could come to you.
Yeah, that was great. And also, luckily, the Library of Congress had, opened to a small number of hours per day. I was able to get in for 3-hour periods in the morning and the afternoon. I will say that one of the most dramatic moments I'd ever experienced doing archival research happened when I was busy. I think it was the second or third day I was in the archives at the Library of Congress. And all of a sudden, alarm bells started ringing. And we were hustled, all the researchers who were in the Madison building were hustled out of the building very fast by security. And it was only later when I got to my hotel that I switched on the news and found that there was a would-be bomber who had parked his truck in front of the main Library of Congress and had threatened that he had a bomb in his truck and was going to blow it up. Fortunately, that turned out not to be the case. And we were all able to go back into the archives the next day. So I had a bit of taste of what Brown might have experienced, being in a war zone, walking down the streets of Saigon, where any moment, a VC sapper could blow up a bar or a restaurant. Not that dramatic as he experienced, but still got the blood pumping.
It does give you a feeling for it. It reminds me of when I was doing my Rebecca West biography in the early 1990s. And this was still a time of the Troubles in Ireland. And it was a time when there were assassination attempts and bombings in London. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to one interview to interview a friend of Rebecca West. And I was in the tube, mm-hmm. in the subway. And suddenly there was this alarm. We all had to clear out because there had been this, bomb threat. It was the Baker Street Station. I immediately started thinking of Sherlock Holmes, identifying not only with the war correspondent, in a sense, people in war, but with detectives as well.
Yeah, it's usually more quiet when you're doing archival research. It's a very solitary thing, but also very peaceful.
But there is this connection. Not all biographers think of themselves as journalists, and yet there is, I do. I taught in the journalism department for several years. I wasn't trained as a journalist like Brown. It was sort of on the job training. Mm-hmm. Once I got into biography and either because I was dealing with the biography of a journalist or simply because I was trying to get the story. Mm-hmm. Biographers like journalists have to do all sorts of things in terms of travel and sometimes risk taking to get the story. It really is a kind of there was a biographer some years ago who edited a collection of essays called Biography is High Adventure. Mm.
It sometimes can be that as journalism, of course, if you're someone like Brown who wanted to be a foreign correspondent after he got into journalism, first working at a small newspaper in Middletown, New York. But he got a taste for what adventurous life could be as a reporter when they sent him to Cuba to cover the revolutionary government of Fidel Castro early on. And that really whetted his appetite. And he'd always loved Asia from his time serving in the army in South Korea, wanted to get back there. And so when the Associated Press hired him, they decided to send him to Saigon, where, you know, this civil war was going on. And he was thrust himself right into the middle of the war and started writing about it and trying to get people back in the United States interested in what was going on, which was difficult because, you know, both the Diem administration and the John Kennedy administration wanted to keep the war off the front pages of newspapers. And they kind of treated it as a little secret war because the Kennedy administration didn't want people to know that American advisors were not just advising their South Vietnamese counterparts, but were actually, you know, involved in a shooting war and were suffering casualties and were taking hits, just like the Arvin troops that they were helping out.
Yeah, we don't know, of course. It's a counterfactual, but imagine if it had all been exposed. Mm-hmm. And people had learned what kind of government was in place in South Vietnam. And if reporters had been freer to roam around, it might have been a different story.
Well, there's a road not taken in the fact that instead of, you know, stiff-arming the young reporters there like Brown, Halberstam, and Neil Sheehan of United Press International, they had the American officials there in the embassy and elsewhere had taken them into the confidence and saying, hey, yeah, look, this is what's going on. You know, you've got to help us out here. But there was always this pressure to get on the team and yes, to report only what they wanted them to report and not tell what they saw as what was really going on in the countryside. And these, you know, promises, the views of, you know, there's the light at the end of the tunnel that, you know, we're winning the war, things are going well, wasn't always the case.
And so, yeah, it gets caught up in the ideological conflict, you know, it's, mm-hmm, it's us against them. It's the communists, you know, right. we can't let them spread their ideology and so on. The facts of the reporting get sort of swallowed up in that ideological conflict, I think.
Indeed. And, you know, these young reporters went to South Vietnam as supporting, you know, our efforts against the communists. They,
yes,
they didn't go there as anti-war or anti our help to South Vietnam. At first, they thought, well, you know, this is the young, you know, supposedly a democracy and fighting communists, and of course, America should help them out. But, you know, once they got there and saw what was going on the ground, going out and, as Brown said, getting their boots muddy and seeing what was going on in the countryside, they saw that things weren't going well, and they had to report what they saw and what they experienced out in the field.
Yeah, yeah. Brown really immersed himself in the culture there.
He did.
Even in terms of his romantic life.
That's right. He met a young woman who was in the South Vietnamese Information Ministry and had gone to see her to get the proper documentation for covering the war early on, a young woman named Lee Lu. And they you know, fell in love, and eventually in 1966 they were married. And so he learned a lot about the country and got to know her family and got to know a lot about Vietnamese culture. I think he was helped early on because he could speak French. Of course, there's a big French influence in Vietnam, so that helped him out. He tried to learn as much Vietnamese as he could. And there's a dramatic scene later on when there's a lot of animosity against the journalists. There are two secret policemen who knock on his apartment door. He and Li Lu had started living together. And Brown, in his travels around the country and his connections with spies and Green Berets and other unsavory characters sometimes, had come across and gotten a hold of a World War II era German submachine gun. And he had it in his apartment for protection. And he saw these two secret policemen at his front door and thought that things didn't look on the up and up, and carried the submachine gun with him as he answered the door. And once they saw that, they knew they were outnumbered. All they had were pistols. And so they retreated, and things were back to normal for a time.
Yeah, that's a great scene in the biography. Mm-hmm. He pulls out his machine gun. Yeah. Not exactly what they were expecting.
No, it's so, hard to be outgunned by a reporter. That's something you're going to see.
A reporter who carries not only a camera, mm-hmm. but a submachine gun. Okay.
Or at least had it in his apartment for protection. Yeah. He didn't carry with him always, but yeah.
So what happens after Vietnam to Malcolm Brown?
Brown's really... The book is a story of, there's three stories involved. There's a story of Brown and how he becomes a journalist. Of course, there's a story of Brown and how he came to get that dramatic, iconic photo of the monks' immolation. And then there's a story of Brown, I think Brown and Vietnam itself. He was there from 1961 to 1966. Of course, he worked for the AP. He transitioned to ABC television as a correspondent for them. That didn't work out. He remained in Vietnam for a short time, writing articles for True Magazine, which was a men's magazine in the 1960s, and writing about the war in Vietnam. He eventually got a foundation grant from the Council for Foreign Relations, returned to the United States for a time, and then went to work for the New York Times as a foreign correspondent, and really traveled all around the world, South America, Central America, Russia, but kept going back to Vietnam. Things were happening. In 1972, there was a major offensive by the North Vietnamese. The Times Bureau in Saigon needed an extra hand, so Brown went back to report on the war. And he returned again in 1975 for the final North Vietnamese offensive against Saigon, and was there and had left shortly before the North Vietnamese troops captured Saigon. He was on one of those evacuation helicopters looking back, seeing buildings burning, South Vietnamese trying to escape on boats to the American fleet offshore, and spilled a lot of tears as he looked back and realized that it was all over for the South Vietnamese. Eventually, went to the for the Times, became a science writer. So he returned to his first love at the end of his life, before his retirement in 2000, and wrote a well-regarded science column for the Times.
He also tried to write fiction. What happened?
I think a couple times he tried to write books and tried to encapsulate his experience as a reporter in South Vietnam. But as a lot of reporters, when they turn their hands to fiction, it doesn't always work out, and he could never find a publisher for his work. I think he just, perhaps was too factual in his writing for a novel. When I read it in his papers, it didn't capture the excitement of the times as much as his reporting had. So it's just two different kinds of writing. I don't think he was well versed in one kind, but perhaps not enough in the other.
Yeah, it's very difficult. There are some people who can bring off doing both the journalism and the fiction, but it's certainly two very different kinds of creativity.
I know that I stick to nonfiction myself. I've not had very luck in writing any kind of fiction.
That's a serious problem for me. Occasionally, I have tried writing fiction, and I finish a sentence or a paragraph, and I say, is this as good as Faulkner? No.
No.
No, it isn't. I know
that's a high bar. You set for yourself, Carl.
But you see, and this is probably not true either, but when I write a biography, when I'm in the midst of doing the work and so on, as a biographer, I don't think, well, this is not as good as somebody else. I'm operate under this illusion that I'm as good as anybody else. I can't do that with fiction. But with nonfiction, it may be an illusion, but it keeps me going.
That's a good way to look at it, I think. That's something I'll have to take on as I do my feature books.
Yeah, yeah. So do you have a next?
I do. I've had good luck here in working with the University of New Mexico Press, which has published my books on Dragascus and now Malcolm Brown. So I had hooked on another reporter. I just can't keep off of writing about journalists for some reason.
Yeah.
A gentleman named Wallace Terry, who was raised in Indianapolis. So I'm writing about a fellow Hoosier again, and was a reporter, covered the civil rights movement in the 1960s for the Washington Post, moved on to Time magazine, became one of the first major African-American journalists hired by such a major national publication. And they sent him to Vietnam, and he was there reporting on the war, and did a lot of interviews with Black soldiers while he was in Vietnam, and decided, you know, he wanted to write a book, came back home, and spent years, more than a decade, trying to get his book published about the experiences of African-American soldiers during the war. Finally was able to do so when he turned it into kind of an oral history, and it was eventually published in the 1980s as Bloods, which is really a groundbreaking book and is held in high regard even today, where he's able to get the firsthand tales of what it was like to be a Black soldier during the Vietnam War. So I'm doing a biography of Mr. Terry and working once again with the University of New Mexico Press.
That sounds great. Sounds fascinating. It also raises the issue of career choices. After I finished my biography of Rebecca West, a biographer of Oscar Wilde said to me, he said, you know, well, this, the book was well-received, well-reviewed, and so on. She said, you know, you should continue in this vein, you know, pick some subject that's similar to that. So that, she didn't use the word brand, but that's essentially what she was saying. People didn't use that word in the 1990s. And the same brand was certainly around, but developing your brand, that phrase, I don't think was available to us in the 1990s. But essentially, I was told that, you know, that you should cultivate this particular area because that's how you're going to really get known. It was really sound advice. And you know what, Ray? I didn't take it.
I decided to go hither and yon in your subject. That's good.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You mentioned Oscar Wilde there, and there's an interesting fact involving Malcolm Brown that I didn't mention before, but he is was related to Oscar Wilde.
Oh,
in fact, his middle name is Wilde. It's Malcolm Wilde Brown.
W, yeah.
But because of his Wilde's controversial, character, if you want to call it that, Brown, when he was a young man, kind of kept that secret. And it was only later in life when he realized that it's a connection that he should be proud of.
Yeah. If he had been able to write fiction, he could have sort of altered his name a little bit. He could have said, you know, Malcolm Wilde.
That's Brown. Right. That might be, that might have been an entree into the fictional world that he should have used at that time.
So what didn't I ask you that you wanted to say about your book? Anything?
We covered a lot of ground there. One thing I should mention is Brown, of course, because of his experience in war and seeing a lot of bloodshed, a lot of awful things. He wasn't a religious man. He didn't rely on that to have his soul satisfied. But later in life, in the 1970s, and a couple of times, he was able to go to Antarctica on some scientific expeditions and write about it for the New York Times. And he found a lot of comfort in being in that forsaken landscape. And it gave him, I think, a lot of peace. And it really was good for his nerves and good for his system as well. And being someone who was involved in seeing a lot of death, he said it was you know, good for him, because he realized even at the end of his life that, you know, death wasn't that bad even sometimes.
Yeah, that's a very interesting notion. Yeah, he, you know, I say about biography, you write about someone who's intrinsically interesting. And I think Malcolm Brown is. It's more than just the reporting about Vietnam that makes him a good biographical subject.
He's someone it was easy to spend time with, and that's what I always look for when I tackle a subject. Someone you're going to have, you might not agree with always their choices in life or yeah. what they do with it, but you respect them and feel good about letting other people in on their inner lives and their experiences during it.
Yeah. Well, it's been a pleasure, Ray.
Great to talk with you again, Carl. Thank you for everything.
Yeah, we'll have to do it again.
I hope so. In a couple of years, we'll be back again.
Yes, we'll be back. As Norman Mailer said, like the mad butler serving the meal.
There you go. Good.
Okay. Talk to you later, Ray.
Thanks, Carl.
Sure.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.